can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
The Department of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, was recently honored to host acclaimed Haitian American writer Edwige Dantika on June 1st and 2nd, 2004. Edwige Dantika is an internationally known writer who has received many, many literary accolades for her work. Edwige Dantika's first book, Breath Eye Memory, which recounts the story of a young girl immigrating to the United States and is partly autobiographical, was selected as an Oprah Book Club. Her second volume, Creek Crack, was a National Book Award finalist, and she received the 1999 American Book Award, among other prizes that she has received for her work, which has been already translated in over 10 languages, including French, Spanish, German, Finnish, Korean, and Japanese. Her most recent work, A Butterfly Away, a collection of writing by Haitians, and some children's stories, Behind Mountains, received a number of prizes in 2003. Let me maybe to give you a sense of the positioning of this writer, use a paraphrase from the protagonist from Behind the Mountains, the young girl Celiane, who says, I had this dream after the bombing that I could not remember my name, that I could not remember who I was. I was afraid that nobody would find me. This is typical of what Dantika writes about. She writes about the voiceless, those who have no face, who have been oppressed for too long, who have suffered violence. Edwige Dantika's work is about the greater good for humanity in general. She stands up against oppression. She writes about resistance and hope. She writes about ties that binds, about ways of working in solidarity with others. She writes about retelling, recounting, remembrance. She is a voice who tells the story of those who are not able to tell their own stories. It is a privilege to have her here with us. There'll be right now a conversation between Dr. Marlene Racine Toussaint, a leading feminist who have really stood up for Haitian women for over 40 years in Haiti and outside, and also the founder of Multicultural's Women's Press. So now, Edwige Dantika and Dr. Marlene Racine Toussaint.
I'm Marlene Racine Toussaint, the president of Multicultural Press, a small publishing house. It is my pleasure to introduce today Edwige Dantika, the illustrious writer of Haitian descent. And she's a Regents Lecturer in the Department of Black Studies of the University of Santa Barbara, California. University of California, Santa Barbara. Edwige, you write fiction. Why?
I write fiction because I love stories. And I've had the privilege of always having been told stories and just being caught up in something made up and having no accountability and just seeing where your imagination leads you. So I've always loved stories, stories told, oral stories growing up, and then loved reading. So for me, it's a natural progression. So I tell lies for a living.
Well, but you write different genres, like, of course, fiction, and you edited several volumes, like The Butterfly's Way, with Pecan Press, and you have a lot of your work has been translated in how many languages do you know exactly?
A few, about 10.
In 10 languages?
Yes.
Do you speak any of the languages beside English? And
I speak some French, and unfortunately, I think the language closest to the work, which is Haitian Creole, the work hasn't been translated in Creole, but those are about the only ones I speak, and a little Spanish. But.
Okay, you have two children's books. You seem to be, you like to write children's stories. What's, your relationship with children?
Well, I think it goes back to the first question, and that I've always, I was introduced to stories as a child, and so I'm always interested in how children receive a story, and so along with the adult books that I've written, I've always come back either through essays, through writing, children's stories, and also it's interesting to observe what happens to children in an immigrant family, because there's so, the experiences of parents, of grandparents, are so detached from the children who are born here, and to see their progression, to see their experience, and to even see the interaction of the children. So that's why, after writing several books for adults, I was curious about writing for children, and in some ways trying to transport some of our stories to these children who may never know the places we come from, who may never know Haiti. My nieces and nephews who range from 5 to 10 months won't know Haiti in the same way that my parents did, definitely not in that way, or in the way that I did. So my work, which has sort of slowly progressed towards some work for children, has to do with that, with the fact that of translating or re-relating some of the stories that made me a fiction writer, some of the stories that made me love stories.
Simone de Beauvoir said a writer is someone who has read a lot. Were you an avid writer?
I was
an avid reader.
Reader, yes. I was always an avid reader. I mean, definitely drawn in by storytelling, and the fact that I think, growing up in Haiti, some of us, if you were lucky enough to go to school, you go to a very rigorous program in school, and so that it's not, people weren't even afraid to give you a big book if you were able to read it. So I remember, before I was 12, like reading Victor Hugo or reading Emile Zola and those kinds of stories, because if you could read them, you read them. Nobody said, "Oh, this is too old for you," or "This is too young for you." So I read everything I could find. So I think that also, that feeds your desire for stories. And I think a writer is interested in stories. And if you're lucky, you can be a writer without ever reading, maybe. But I think it's the one thing that feeds that interest in you if you start reading early.
When do you write?
Well, I write, if I'm lucky, I write all the time. But I find it easier to write at night because of, there's something about the night, I think, that just fades out everything else and allows easier, allows it for you to imagine. And I always feel like allows the spirits to find me, these characters that are like ghosts, to find me. And, in the book The Color Purple, at the end of the book, Alice Walker writes, she thanks the characters for coming. And I just feel like, sometimes I feel like, for me, the characters travel at night. They don't, because there's just too many people walking around in the daytime in their way. It's like they're like ghosts, they find you at night. So I find it easier to write at night. But once I get started, if I'm inside a story, I feel like it's a trance, like I can't stop, and I'll stop to eat. And when I was living by myself, I was just kind of like, I would do that. It would be a month, like people wouldn't see me. I would just do it. But, now, it's like if you have more interactions, if you have to stop. So that sort of life puts that in your way, that you have to sort of these structures. But when it's really going well, I just feel like I'm writing all the time. And even when you're not writing, sometimes you're writing because you're thinking about it, you're outlining things, you can be in the shower and things are coming. So when I'm lucky, I'm always writing, even if I'm not sitting down somewhere with a pen.
Do you have, at home, do you have a special spot where you sit and write?
Yes, I try to have a special spot. The last couple of years, I've been different shifts, so my spot has been shifting. But it's the most comforting thing for me. Like, there are people who kind of dream of going to a beautiful place, looking at an ocean to write. I find it very difficult to not be around my things, you know, in some ways. Like, if I'm writing, I want to be able to reach for a book that I know exactly, you know, I can reach without even looking. And so I like to have that sense of familiarity around me, but still have quiet or still have, you know. So I try to carve a little place like that wherever I am, or if I'm on the road, or even if I'm at home. I definitely have a room at home, but it wasn't always so, you know, because I grew up, I have three brothers, and when I was growing up, I would just wait for everybody to fall asleep, and that's, thus comes this habit of writing at night.
Do you write on several projects at a time, like several books, several manuscripts at the same time, or you take it one by one?
Yeah, I feel like I have to do it one by one. I can do short if I'm doing an article or something, but really things just occupy me totally. Like, I can't do many things at the same time. But in an early stages, if I'm researching something, then I could do several things. But even just, it's hard to even do life things, you know, like, when I'm really deep in writing, I find it even hard to do my laundry. So I have to just give it all one thing.
You write, do you have a specific audience when you're writing? Are you thinking about a specific audience? Because I know you write, you're read by everyone in the world almost, and do you, when you start, do you target a specific audience?
That's a question that comes up all the time, and it's a very valid question. For me, when I write, my audience is really several faces I think about, and I think it's less intimidating to think about a lot of people, but you think about a couple of people. One, the first person I think of the girl I was when I was 15, and it's really true. I think of this girl who was in the Brooklyn Public Library looking for books about, you know, Haitian Americans, and looking for those books. So I think of that, and I think of my brothers. Two of my brothers and my family, the two of us who were born in Haiti, two of us who were born here. And I think of my brothers who don't necessarily, they don't read French, they don't read Creole, but they're very, you know, they grew up in this very, very vibrant Haitian household and speak Creole, but they don't read it. And so I think of them, and I think of writing for them and for their, you know, for my nieces and nephews and other people. So it depends. With each book, I'll think of one specific person. You know, for example, now I'm writing another book for kids about Anna Kaona, who is sort of our great, you know, a name that's called often in Haiti, who was a Taino leader about the same region that my family's from in Haiti, from Léogâne. And so when I was writing about Anna Kaona, I thought about my niece who was born last year. You know, her name is Zora. You know, she's named for Zora Neale Hurston. And so I'm thinking of her reading that when she's in, you know, when she's 10, and thinking about Haiti. Mm-hmm. And so I always think, with each one, I think, you know, they have a kind of specific, parent or marin or somebody. Mm-hmm. I think, oh, if I could give that person a gift, like I thought when my niece was born, I thought if I can give her a gift, you know, being born in the year 2003, this is what I would give her. So this is really, I think of audience as like really one person at a time.
Would you consider yourself a miserabilist? I mean that you write about pain, about struggles, people's struggles, the, you know, different sort of painful things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope I'm not a miserabilist, but, you know, but then I think of other, you know, I think of actually going back to like Émile Zola and stories of writing about people's daily struggles. And I think it's something that I that I tr- struggle with all the time myself, in the sense that, you know, coming from Haiti, which, as we know, has this very powerful culture, has this great beauty and this amazing things, but also has this very painful history. You know, this year, 2004, we're celebrating the bicentennial of Haitian independence, and it's almost, you know, there's almost like a series of plagues, even if we talk about things that are happening right now today with these floods that are made even worse by the environmental situation, that then will worsen the situation. And I just remember thinking the other day when the flood started and somebody said, oh, there's an earthquake on top of this flood, you know, and you just feel like, you know, there's like this series of, you know, just miserable circumstances that's balanced with all of that. And so I don't feel like I'm making a choice, like a necessary choice to highlight certain things. But for me, I've always had this balance around me. You know, I've always known that there's this balance. But in some ways, I think there's something about maybe my character, where so I'm drawn to this other part of it. You know, I'm drawn to these things. These are the things that compel me to write, you know, these more painful things. And I think in drama, in the act of creation anyway, this in this genre, in fiction, you know, or in plays and other things, there is that intent, you know, built in, there is the conflict, you know, and we come from this history with so much conflict, you know, dramatic conflict, you know, sometimes things that you couldn't make up. So it's, I think it's just, I feel like my work is just drawn to that conflict, and it seeks to explore, to understand that, you know, the more difficult part of Haiti, which is then balanced with, you know, and some with stories like the stories of Anna Kaona, which, and its beauty too is a story of conflict, because in the end she's this woman who fought, you know, just like the last woman fighting, but was hung at the end, you know, and the first of many people killed in this way in this country. So I feel like that's the side that draws me, not to say that there's not also this, you know, the other things like carnival and things I've written about, paintings and other things, but in the genre that I write, you know, these are the conflicts that I'm seeking personally to understand, which then makes their way into the fiction.
Mm-hmm. You know, the grand dame of the Haitian literature, Paulette Poujol-Auriol, said, "Happy stories do not make good novels."
God bless her for that. I'm telling you.
I guess you just answered the question. Do you pick themes, you know, or do you feel compelled to write, you know, about the realities? I mean, you had just...
Yeah. No, I mean, because, I mean, I completely agree with that. And I think the conflict only comes in our case, you know, where people will say to a novelist, you know, someone who writes a painful story, why don't you write a happy one, you know? Mm-hmm. That only comes because we have so many unhappy stories in life that people sometimes, they want you to write this, you know, sort of these pleasure plays in a way. But that's, you know, that you can't really have a story without some conflict. And so there would always be some kind of obstacle to fight anyway in any kind of story that wasn't anyway an interesting story. Even if you think of, you know, the folk tales we told, all the songs, you know, the Fiet la lo kon manje timoun, you know, the Toto Marcus, it goes back to the Brothers Grimm. And if you put these things in our stories, you know, even children's stories that are honest with children have very dark conflicts.
Some speak about what they see, you know, sort of divine inspirations. When you write, you say you light candles and you pray. Do you feel divinely inspired?
Well, I think, you know, it's in some ways it's giving what we do too big a place. But I do think there's a kind of, when things are working well, it's like you're a vessel. You're just some things are coming through, and it's like, you know, with the epigraph with Alice Walker saying, thanking these characters for coming. Mm-hmm. I think in all creative acts, you know, there's a kind of magic or mystical thing that we don't understand ourselves. Because even sometimes if you when you reread certain things, you know, it's happened to me that people in my family will say there will be something in the stories and in the book, and they will say, how did you know that? You know, this happened when you were born, and nobody talked about it. And Amy Tan, you know, the Chinese-American writer, talks about that in her family, things like that, where people, you know, would ask her, well, how did you know that? And some, you know, and maybe there are imprints, you know, there are some things that subconsciously, you know, are part of your being that you know. And I think of this example of, you know, there's a, you know, I'm obsessed with butterflies. You know, there's the example of the monarch butterfly, which is this butterfly that just makes this trek across the country, but it dies when it gets where it's going. And it just, it cocoons, you know, they have their butterfly offsprings, but they die. And then the offsprings go back. And they know the way, you know, to go back. And I think of that sort of this extraordinary example, and that sometimes maybe in all our DNA there are some stories that are just imprinted, you know. And so I think we're every, you know, if somebody told you to dance outside naked in the rain to get closer to that, you would, you know. It's just that there are ways that think we all, that's the act of creation. That's why writers drink or take drugs or whatever and do other things. You know, we're all trying to connect to that bigger thing that we don't understand. Like, how does this story come to you? And why does it come some days and it doesn't come some other days? So it's like that mystery of it, I think. And being also coming where we come from, you know, where you sort of, you just feel sometimes a little closer to the spirits. You know, you're always trying to, you're trying to understand that, or at least to remain favorable so that at least they'll come to you.
You seem to be profoundly attached to Haiti. Why is that, since you left at a very early age?
Well, I think part of it is because I didn't leave of my choice. I didn't leave of my own choosing. I think it's something I've thought about over time, and it was a really a big shock for me, this departure, you know. And I was at an age where I could, you know, I had some attachments aside from my family that were my own. So leaving, you know, just one day being told you had to leave and suddenly you have to go, I think, is the thing that sort of, I always wanted to go back, and writing is one other way of going back. And so I think this attachment comes from that, you know, from the sort of the pool of that departure, you know. And we have a young man, Asoto Saint, who was a performance artist, a writer in New York, who was a dancer, and he actually, he talks about, there's a poem that he has a poem where he talks about losing his childhood, you know, on the plane between Port-au-Prince and New York City, and just feeling like in this vessel, you know, in this machine, he just became another person, and he, it was this kind of schizophrenia, you know, where part of your life is left here, and then this other part of you starts from the day you arrive here. And so I think that attachment is I just felt like I just, you know, I always had that feeling when I left, you know, that I was like, one more day, you know, I wanted one more day. And every time I go back to Haiti, it's like trying to get that one more day there.
Family, you said very important to you. And the birth of your niece or nephew have made an impact on your life, and how do you explain that?
Well, you know, I was 30 when my first niece was born, and she was the first grandchild in my family. And I remember I wrote an essay about her birth for Essence magazine, because it was really this extraordinary event in my family, because we. It was as if, you know, we had the two. This was the child of my brother who was born, who was with me in Haiti, and then I have two brothers who were born here. So this was really our first American child, you know, like her mother is from Jamaica. And so it's like she just came, like she came out of this soil. And the fact, I think it was profound for all of us that she would have been a different child or a different thing if my brother had stayed in Haiti. So it was really impactful for all of us. And there was my mother who was saying, well, will this child speak Creole, you know, and what does that mean, you know, this sort of this family moving in this other direction. And so I think it gave us all pause, and it made us all think, and especially for me too. And and exploring that. And then my nephew was born, and it was the same thing, because he was like the first male child of this new generation. And then my other niece was born last year, and she's a different being altogether, because she's sort of neither like these other two. She's kind of this really robust and strong child, and very forceful, you know, and her, you know, and even just very young, and just you could tell she's going to have, you know, she bears the name of Zora Neale Hurston, as I said, and just has that spirit. And so I think it just forces you to imagine these things, you know, even people who had been nurturing this dream of going back to Haiti, you just now you realize, yeah, there's like now this whole other branch of the family that's very American. And so that gave me a lot of, give us all a lot to think about.
Generations, I mean, being connected, relationship, you know, between women, how do you, you know, explain that? Because it comes out a lot in your books.
Well, I think it goes back, I mean, a lot of it goes back to the personal, you know, the fact that, you know, my family, my father left Haiti when I was 2 and my mother when I was 4. And I grew up in a way surrounded by women who were not my mother, but who were, in each of their ways, mothers to me. So this very strong idea of surrogate mothering and passing on, and also growing, you know, with other children in the same situation whose mothers were in other places, whose mothers had passed on and other women had taken in. And so for me, that line was very important. And I've always had this model, not without idealizing this, of very strong women who were, for, you know, for different reasons, either because their husbands had been killed during the dictatorship or had to just take in this situation. But I would see their, you know, they would be this person to me, you know, who was this high, and they were giants. And sometimes when they went out into the world, people didn't value them in the same way. So that, when I started writing, I naturally wanted to write about these kinds of women because I didn't see many of them in the things that I was reading. So for me, it was a kind of an act of honoring, of wanting to honor women like that without idealizing, without making them, you know, too infallible, you know, just honoring that, but also explaining their complexity and examining that, looking at that and how they survived.
Your style of writing, I mean, it's simple but yet powerful. What do you do, I mean, with the people, you know, we left behind, that particular theme that you seem to write about all the time? Why is that?
Well, I think my style is really modeled after very first experiences in stories, and just having an experience where someone tells you a story and you can take out of it what you want. And in that way, a story is like a gift. And one thing that I noticed, you know, from hearing stories told when I was very young, that a really good, you know, good orator in the sense of an oral story will do 3 things for you. You know, the first thing is they'll just draw you out of your daily experience, which I think the Haitian storytelling, you know, with the transitional phrases like team team, washesh, creek, crack. So you're transitioning from your life to this other space. And then the storyteller, the really great storyteller, keeps you there. And you know, when we were being told the story, if you were drifting off to sleep, or if there was a song, you know, and there were movements. It was like there was this kind of theatrical. And then the third aspect is that you always remember it at the end. You know, you remember it so much that sometimes you want to pass it on. So I try to model that same thing in the stories that I'm, you know, that I tell, in the simplicity, without, you know, so that you always, you're just wrapped up in the story, and that the story is something to pass on, because, you know, the idea of thinking of the people we left behind, of the things we left behind, because a lot of us, when we came here, you know, when my parents came and when others came, or when I came, you know, there's a limit to how much you can bring. You know, you can bring 2 suitcases, 70 pounds each, you know, so you can't bring your chaudier, your big pot. You have to improvise.
Some people do.
Yeah, I know. I had to bring one for somebody one time. But you bring, the most of what you bring really are your memories, you know, are the things that you remember and what you do with them. And really, I think those are the things that sustain people. So really, I feel like that's always the underlayer of my work. Like, these are the things that I was able to bring with me, you know, embellished by things that I've experienced here, of course. But, you know, these are also the things that I would want to leave, you know, when I leave this stage of my existence, you know.
Are you a feminist?
Yes. Wow, I am definitely a feminist.
Wonderful.
I don't think enough young women, I think people often say, you know, I'm a feminist, but, or, you know, mm-hmm. And I think young women these days are a little bit afraid to say that they're feminist, but I'm definitely a feminist and a womanist in the Alice Walker sense, you know, of, you know, a feminist and also, you know, acknowledging the specific elements of feminism in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, Haitian women, especially poor Haitian women, but, oh, you know, Haitian women have always been feminists.
Yes.
You know, have lived the feminism, you know, mm-hmm. without much, you know, theorizing about it, which I'm much, you know, talking about it, but have lived a very strong, you know, feminist
before
existence.
Before the time, like, we've always practiced proto-feminism.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. I mean, in many cases, not having a choice, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, so I think, but you will find many younger women, or younger Haitian women, who would be afraid, even if they're living a very feminist life, you know, would be afraid to say they're feminist, because there's this sometimes this interpretation, even women, young women here, that means you hate men and certain things. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. but I'm definitely a feminist. And actually, these I had a friend send to me, someone from Ms. Magazine sent to me, I'd requested it because they had their, for the march, the women's march, they had made these shirts that says, this is what a feminist looks like. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you could, when you wear your shirt, then they'll see the different faces of feminism.
Mm-hmm. Now, personal pain, you know, not being allowed to go to Carnival, and yet after many years you return and you wrote about Carnival. Tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a little book about Carnival called After the Dance, and it was really, I mean, it was a great experience writing that, because this was something that I always wanted to do when I was a kid, to go to Carnival. But the way it was, too, because I was being raised by my uncle was a Baptist minister, and during Carnival, we would go to the country and work the land. And this was his way of teaching us, too, that, you know, while other people are sort of experiencing this pleasure, you can contribute, you can, you know, we have prayer meetings and different things like that. But, and I just, and like everything else that's forbidden to you, you know, you want to experience it. So a couple of years ago, I had this opportunity to write this book, you know, and they said, you know, it was a book of walks by writers. And so they asked me where I went to walk, and I said, and without a doubt, I said, I want to go to Carnival. And so I started writing this book. And it was really a fun book to write, because it was my first nonfiction book, so it was working in this other kind of genre and doing all this research that was a lot of fun. So it was really a great experience.
Now, about funerals, mm-hmm. you know, you were like forced to be at funerals every day wearing the same white dress. How does that, memory-wise, how is this affecting you now, these days, you know, or in your writings?
Well, my uncle, again, the minister, because we were sort of the core, like the minister's family, and in some ways an extension of his life. So we would, you know, he and his wife and my brother and me and my cousins, we would have to go to all the funerals. Strangely enough, we didn't have to go to the weddings he presided over. We weren't invited to those. But the funerals, we had to go as a family to show our respects a lot. And I had a funeral dress, you know, and that I wore to all the funerals. And it gave me, I mean, going to those funerals, it gave me this really, I had to not be afraid of this process, you know, of which was a very deep aspect of my life, not to be afraid. I had to kind of develop a philosophy early about death, which sounds, it sounds scary, but wasn't, because it made me really at ease with it. And really it became this thing that was like, like St. Augustine says, like death is just like another door to another room. And I had, because you see it, having seen it so much, the funeral, the burial and all that. So it became easy to think about death, at least easier to think about this idea that is a kind of transition. And I really, just balancing all the beliefs that different people had of it. Of course, my uncle's, the Judeo-Christian belief that, this person was, that's their body and that they were going somewhere else. And, mm-hmm. and also, the other ancestral beliefs that this was like one stage of their life was over, but that they were still around. And just balancing everything somebody said about death, for example, was helpful to me being at these funerals, because it made it, it just made it something else that you do. And I've gone back now to funerals. When my aunt who raised me, she died last year in February, when I went back, and I would look at the children at the funeral. They had like the children's choir, because she was the minister's wife who sang there, and the children didn't seem afraid. If anything, there was a kind of curiosity that I vaguely remember in myself, and seeing what someone you had seen, walking mm-hmm. around, what they look like now, and this kind of peaceful look on their face. So I think that gave me this sort of fascination mm-hmm. with death that then comes through the work. And even in the Carnival book, it starts in a cemetery, and I'm very intrigued by cemeteries.
Mm-hmm. You said that you've always been you enjoyed cemeteries. Is that some sort of a connection with the past?
I think so. I mean, I think it's sort of, in the way that in the book, when I go to the cemeteries, when I would talk to people about cemeteries, and they would say, this proverb that, people don't have, you don't own any real house except where you're buried, except of your cave, your mausoleum. I mean, that's the only house you really own, And so this idea of, these cemeteries and walking around a cemetery and this, this, the vibes that I feel, that you just feel are this kind of idea that that this is everybody's last place. I mean, that's always, it sounds gory, but it's intriguing to me. But it's not gory in the sense that if you go to Haiti, in some places, when I was writing the book too, in the section about cemeteries, there's a place up in Cap Rouge in the mountains of Jacmel where they have the most extraordinary mausoleums. And oftentimes the mausoleums are so, in Haiti people have, in the country they'll have the house and then the mm-hmm. the grave right behind.
In the backyard.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, but in Cap Rouge they were the most extraordinary ones. Like the house would be very simple, but the mausoleum, behind there would be so extraordinary. And some of them looked like they were just like these Middle Eastern tombstones and just influences that was hard to trace. And so those kinds of connections and why, there's an easiness with death too when you think about that this person lives here. And we've had instances where we know friends who buy land from somebody when the family's no longer there with the one condition that they keep the grave there. Like I'll sell you the house or sell you the land, but just have to kind of make, just make the space. Like you can't just mm-hmm. unearth a cemetery, mm-hmm. somebody's mm-hmm. mausoleum or tombstone. So that whole, I think, transition, this feeling with death, which I think we all have, as a people, a lot of us have anyway. But for me, just started that with the church at these funerals and just continues. And I think will makes it a lot easier for me to accept that, not any less painful, but sort of a lot easier to accept that transition when it happens in my own life, when I lost my aunt, for example, or when I lose people who are close to me.
The farming of bones. This happened in 1937, way before your time. I know you are very much interested in history, and why did you pick this particular subject? And I know you did a lot of research. But
well, that was one of those other subjects I feel like that calls you. And when I was growing up, you know, I knew a lot, I'd heard a lot of, about a lot of people who had gone to the Dominican Republic to cut sugarcane. And then years and years later, I was working in a production office and met this artist whose grandmother had survived this massacre, and he had painted something, he had painted this, her survival, in this very simple but graphic way. And it was a picture of the river with a trail of blood, and he wrote, "My grandmother told me that the Massacre River ran with blood." Mm-hmm. And the Massacre River is a river that's between Haiti and Dominican Republic, and it's called that not because of this massacre, but because of a massacre between French and Spanish colonizers. And so that painting just brought that back to me, and then I started researching the story, and had found out, you know, like, that there was never any commemoration of this massacre. And I find that even today, you know, young Haitians don't know about it, but young Dominicans, a lot of them do, like they know about it. But a lot of young Haitians don't know about it. So I started writing the story, but I wasn't sure how to approach it. So I wrote a story, a sort of a mother-daughter story that's in Kwikak, and with the at the beginning, and then it just broadened the subject for me, and I had a character. Once I had this character, Amabel, who's the lead in the book, once I had that story, it sort of broadened, you know, just she came with this whole history, with this whole past that then merged this very complicated history between Haiti and the Dominican Republic and this massacre that happened, you know, in 1937, 2-3 days where 40,000 people were massacred by Trujillo, who was the dictator there for 31 years. And so it was something that, one of those things that did always haunted me, and I just didn't know what to do with for many years. But once this character came, you know, sort of guided me through the whole of the book. But it was interesting. Now people do, you know, they'll read that and they read more about this period, this massacre, because there were always other massacres happening around the world at that time. It was the time of Hitler, the time of, you know, all these other horrible things were happening in the world. So for me, it fit in with that whole line of massacres, in the same way that you could put the massacres 10 years ago in Rwanda and Burundi within the lines of the massacres in Bosnia and Croatia, because, you know, these things aren't isolated. But sometimes our stories, you know, our things are just, you know, just dwarfed in the larger one, or lost, and not that these lives aren't as important, but they become buried, and unless they're told in this other way, and people just learn about them almost accidentally. You know, if you read a novel, then you learn something, and then you research more.
Having written all those stories about the past, memory, and pain, do you feel this has hardened you a little bit? Or what makes you cry, for instance? I mean, while you're writing this thing, do you feel like crying, or what makes you cry? Really,
well, they all. I mean, I feel like, you know, in some ways, these words are my tears. I mean, that's how I cry. The massacre, you know, writing about 1937 was somewhat difficult, and I would have to stop sometimes because there were a few stories, but the ones you had were so graphic. Mm-hmm. So I cry this way. I cry by writing these stories.
You've been called one of Haiti's most distinguished ambassadors. How do you feel about that? What kind of responsibility do you think you have toward, you know, Haiti? And
well, I think we're all in some ways ambassadors of Haiti. There are many. I don't give myself that role solely. You know, I think, you know, I grew up in a household where, like, my mother would say, you know, when you leave this house, you represent Haiti, so you better comb your hair and dress proper because you might be the only Haitian somebody's ever met, you know. And so that was from the time we were all 14, and then so I had that, you know, we all had that role, and, you know, in our different lives. So I'm grateful. I'm extremely grateful for this. Haiti has given me this. You know, it's given me this very these rich stories, and in some ways, all I'm doing is passing them on. You know, in the same way that when you're young, you're told a story and you're itching to pass it on. And what I hope is that other people, you know, when they read these books, then they'll be eager to read other things, that they'll go out and find out more and realize the complexity of this country, the complexity of this history. And if that's an ambassadorship, I accept that. I accept that fully. You know, but that's the only way I can do it. I can't go to the United Nations.
Never know. Now, what at the Festival of Cannes, when they called you or wrote to you asking you to be a member of the jury, what was your reaction?
Well, I was very pleasantly shocked, and it was extraordinary, because I had this moment too where they said, you know, they introduce you in front of the whole plan, and they say l'écrivain haïtien, you know, and they say my name, and I was extremely proud, and like all these things, I mean, that's what the great thing about when these things happen to you is that they don't just happen to me, and that, you know, I have like these school children in Jacmel who saw it and who write to me, and they said, you know, my teacher talked about it, and then it becomes something bigger. I mean, so I think that's the great thing about it. And we got to see a lot of great movies, and I think we made a great choice in terms of the Palme d'Or. So it was a great experience. I loved it.
Well, we are celebrating 200 years of our bicentennial independence. And what are your wishes for Haiti for the future?
Well, I think, I hope, you know, we've had 200 very difficult years. And I think in some ways this is such a symbolic year. And everybody knew it was going to be somewhat bittersweet no matter what. And that, you know, I hope this year, with all that's happened, no matter where people fall there, I hope it becomes, what's left of it, a year of real, true reflection. And that in some ways, I hope we don't keep recycling these things, you know, these occupations, these, mm-hmm. This strife, these differences, and that my dream, you know, like all children of Haiti, I think, is that some way we were able to live the dream of our foremothers and our forefathers, to be truly independent, to be truly free, to come back to this place that gave us this republic, because we needed to be united to fight this struggle to create this country, and that really Haitians realize in the end that we can't move without the other. Like, you can't have two Haitis. We really have to be united, and true to the creed of l'Union fait la force, we really have to be united to have a future. You know, this country is going to have a future, whether it's one that's more horrible than the past, whether it's one that's a little better. We're going to have a future, and we all have to try to build that future. Nobody's going to be able to do it for us. So I hope this year is really a year of reconstruction, and that we stop these patterns of, you know, stop and go of these, you know, we're occupied basically now.
Yeah.
And, you know, to really rebuild a country that can face the world, really, the way we did 200 years ago, and not to stay and linger there, but to talk about it, because this is, you know, this is the bicentennial, but it gives us this opportunity, this symbolic place from which to begin another cycle, and I hope we take that and move on, you know, truly free, truly united, and truly together, so that we can have a future.
And you feel that people in the diaspora, the Haitians, could really help in the reconstruction of Haiti? We should all put or join together. How do you think this can be done?
Well, I think it's important that the people in the diaspora are part of the conversation. And I always tell people, when you go back, I think if they go back with humility, without just stumping their way in, and mm-hmm. just going back with humility and they can make a contribution, and they can actually, in some ways, I think the diaspora's can be a kind of bridge between sometimes in very, you know, polarized situations. Mm. You know, they can be a bridge in this type of conversation. All places, you know, all countries have this where the diaspora comes back in some ways and helps to rebuild. I mean, they can't be the sole factor, you know, but they can in some ways help in this rebuilding. But I think we have to go with humility, with the idea of working together. And a lot of people are doing that. We have to acknowledge that. A lot of people are doing that in their own small community. Mm-hmm. You know, we know people who have built schools in their own small communities, but in a way to join these efforts so that they can have more impact.
Mm-hmm. Now, Doorbreaker, your most recent book, just tell us about it.
Well, The Doorbreaker...
How did you come to write The Doorbreaker?
Mm-hmm. Well, I started... The Doorbreaker is a series of connected short stories, and it ranges from the time of the Duvalier era from 1967 to today, 2004, actually. And it's a series of connected short stories, and The Doorbreaker is a character who was a torturer in a prison in Haiti and now is a barber in Brooklyn. And each of the stories links one person whose life he affected. So I started writing it, one story, and then all these other stories came to it. And the title, The Doorbreaker, comes from, you know, the expression Chouquette mm-hmm. Lahoussaye, who's mm-hmm. someone who stomps and shakes to do.
Well, what is your next project?
Well, I mentioned a little bit. It'll come out next spring. It's a book for children called It's about mm-hmm. Anakaona, who was the Taino mm-hmm. leader. And so that's the next one. And I'm still, you know, my next is percolating. Hopefully, something will come, and someone, that's my Freudian slip, someone,
the divine inspiration,
will find me. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Edwidge. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to interview you. And I also thank the University of California in Santa Barbara. I'm sure it's a great pleasure for them to have you.
Thank you. It was great chatting with you.